The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Good afternoon. I am Vina Jones Cox, and this is Real Life Real Estate Investing, where every week of every year for more years than I care to count now, we've been putting you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. And today is our regular question and answer week. And it's been all confusing because last week we had a notes Q&A week. And then this week when I sent out the e-letter to everybody who is subscribed to that, it had the same subject line as last week, but then we corrected it today. So hopefully y'all know that it's just regular question and answer week. You don't have to stick to the notes thing. And this is going to be the last time for a little while that you're going to hear me here. I've got some business travel and some other things that are taking me away from the show for a few weeks, but that doesn't mean you don't tune in, because we got some good stuff coming up, including George Antone and a day with Jay Redding, who talks about how to sell properties with owner financing of various sorts. And Tiffany Ray will be here 1 week to discuss, to do like group housing Q&A. And next week is Steve Smullen on how to get started, or why commercial real estate rocks. So still some real good shows coming up. Just won't be me. So I need your questions. I mean, that's the bottom line. I need your questions. You can call them in at 877-772-9658, or you can send them via email to vinaradio@gmail.com. Again, that's 877-772-9658, and pretty much any kind of real estate question is perfectly acceptable for today. Gonna start with some of the emails that are in the inbox, that some of which have been here for a little bit. Question from Jonathan that came in after the show we did about, I want to say, a month to maybe 6 weeks ago with Sam Worf and Hannah Fleal, which was about they each do something different in terms of, Sam sells properties on contracts for deed, and Hannah lease options them. And Jonathan had some, apparently listened to the show as it was recorded on realliferealestate.com, and had some questions that I can, in fact, answer. He says, so Hannah was charging an extra amount on the rent each month that was going toward the option, so that she was financing an option, paying installments for the option. That is not what was happening, Jonathan. She was charging extra rent every month. So in other words, if the rent was, she lives in California, so if the normal rent would be $3,500, she would be charging $3,750. But the extra $250 was a rent credit toward the purchase of the property. It's not that she was financing like an option fee or something like that. She collects those up front. And then every month when you pay your rent on time and in full, you get $250 basically as a applied down payment or off the price of the actual house when you buy it. So the option's already set, right? I've already agreed to pay $350,000 for it. I've already put $20,000 up front as an option fee, and now I'm getting $250 a month either toward the down payment, if the lender will let me use it that way, or off the remaining amount that I owe for the house, which is $330. He says, somebody somebody who had a short sale, Hannah mentioned that if they're going to buy a property, they won't qualify for another 3 years, according to FHA. Is that a rule or with FHA, or is there some kind of banking rule about a short sale when and how long it is before somebody can buy using a federally backed loan? It's not that there is a rule. It's that generally, if you are getting an FHA loan, the credit scores that FHA will consider are extremely minimal compared to what would be required for you to get like a Fannie Mae loan. Really minimal. Like I've seen them as low as like 520, which is extremely low credit. Somebody with a 520 credit score doesn't pay all their bills on time. It has a history of not doing that. So generally, FHA, you can get your credit score. It's not that FHA has this rule that says, hey, if you had a short sale 3 years ago, now you can get an FHA loan or you can get an FHA insured loan. It's that after 3 years, if you have kept your nose clean, your credit score would be high enough to get an FHA loan, and FHA would not hold that short sale against you. I have heard, I don't sell to a lot of first-time home buyers, and I've never actually used an FHA loan, and I'm not a mortgage broker, but I have heard that if you reestablish your credit pretty quickly and don't do anything else bad, that you can qualify for an FHA loan 2 years out of bankruptcy. So maybe somebody can confirm that for me. But that's what I have heard. Let's see. With regards to the types of houses that both Sam and Hannah go after, it would seem to me that the owners would cling on pretty tight and not want to give an option on their house if their house is in such good condition. What's the owner's motivation to give an option on a house when they just needed a repair for a house that is in practically great condition? I'm not sure I understand that question, because Sam and Hannah are the sellers in this scenario, Jonathan. And the reason they want to give up the houses is because it meets their investment goals. They are not looking for some other owner to give them an option on a property. They are intentionally, as a business decision, giving an option on that particular property to someone who wants to be a home buyer. So maybe I misunderstood the question. I don't know. But thank you for your question, Jonathan. Again, it's Q&A week. We can take your calls at 877-772-9658 with any real estate question that you have. Or you can send us an email at vinaradio@gmail.com. And we will be back right after this. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. It's question and answer week. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. If you're like, I can't really get to my email and I don't want to call, you do have a third option. You can text us your questions at 513-432-4961. I'll say it again. 513-432-4961. But you got to send them in somehow, or it's going to be a really short show. It's just going to be Bob and I staring at each other for the last 45 minutes of the program, because I didn't come here prepared to say anything in particular. I came here prepared to answer questions. Going back to the email inbox, I've got a question here from Derek. He says, my wife and I own a commercial property for our business. It's about 5,000 square feet. The address is on a side street, but it's right off the major road in our town. The property owner of the building in front of ours, which is on College Street, that's the main road, wants to buy our building. I believe it's because he wants to redevelop it. Our zoning is B1, which in our area means that it can be developed into apartments, retail, office, pretty much anything except manufacturing. A new auto dealership just got built next door, and their apartment complex is going up on the street. We don't currently want to sell, as we do use it for our business, but I can see how the two parcels together are worth more than either one alone. We do plan to sell the company and retire in 5 years when our youngest goes to college, so we were thinking a lease option maybe, or do we just hold it? So, Derek, that is a very interesting question. You don't want to lease option it to this guy because you are using it. And the lease part of that lease option implies that he would have a lease on it. Like he would be in control of the possession and occupancy. And that's what you want right now. The option part is something that you could do. But if the, thanks to the activities of the people all around you, the other properties are getting more and more and more valuable, I don't think I would want to set an option price on it right now. I don't think I'd want to agree to, you know, hey, I think it's worth $800,000, so I'm going to say you can option it for $1 million, and you have to exercise your option in 5 years, and you can't exercise it before that because I'd be a little worried it might be worth $1.5 million. And it wouldn't be because of anything you did. It's because of these apartments and these auto dealerships and things that are going up. You are probably right. The guy in front of you is probably your best buyer because you are probably right. He's probably thinking if I could double the depth of my lot, then someone would want to tear down both properties and put up an apartment building or something, you know, a strip mall or something big. So if he wanted a first right of refusal, I might take a few thousand from him now and say, sure, in 5 years when we decide to sell, we'll put it on the market and you can have first right of refusal for any offer we decide to accept. But because you are still using it, I don't think I would give him a lease option. And because it sounds like other people improving their land is forcing appreciation upon yours, I'm not sure I would do an option unless it was just like a crazy deal. Like if I thought it was worth $750 and he was going to offer me $2 million in 5 years and give me a big old option fee to hold that, I might do that. But otherwise, I think I would maybe just hold on to it if I were you. Because also people's plan for retirement and whatnot, those don't always come together the way you think they're going to. And it would be a real shame if in 5 years he said, okay, time for you to get out. I'm exercising my option because you gave it to me 5 years ago. But a very interesting question. Thank you, Derek. You're listening to Question and Answer Week. 513-432-4961 is the text line if you have a question. You can also send it via email to vinoradio@gmail.com as Daryl from Columbus did. Daryl says, last weekend you referenced leads that are in public record, specifically eviction leads. So that would be I'm reaching out to an owner of a property because he is filing an eviction against his tenant and thus might not be super happy to be owning that rental right at this minute. Would I need to have a person go down and record the cases outside the courtroom? How is this physically done? Okay, so the answer is going to be, I happen to know, Daryl, that you're in Columbus. I'm going to answer the question, and then I'm going to point out that this would be a little bit of a different process depending on where you were in the world. There's the eviction filing, and then there's the eviction hearing. And what you're thinking about is the docket for the eviction hearing where, like, you can, if you have ever gone and had to go to court and do an eviction, there's like a posted outside the courtroom somewhere. There's a list, and the list says, here are the cases that are being heard today. That is not what you want. Because that list of cases being heard today includes, at least where I am, it includes the name of the plaintiff and the name of the defendant. It doesn't include the property address and it doesn't include the address of the plaintiff. That's the owner of the property, which is what I really need to market to them. What you're looking for is the eviction filing. And in Ohio, that is a municipal civil filing, and it should be online. And there's a bunch of evictions that get filed that never actually make it to a hearing because, as you probably know, it's not uncommon that on the day of the eviction, you go over to the house just to check it and the person has already moved out and left the keys. Or alternatively, they get caught up I mean, that's what we hope happens, is they get caught up. So there's, well, I filed the eviction, but I didn't actually have to go to court for the eviction. So there's going to be a lot more filings than there are actual docket evictions. And you can find those online. In every county that I have looked at that was a county that contained a city of any reasonable size, you could find them in, sometimes it's a different, in other states it's a different court, it's like a housing court, but here it's just a civil, it's a civil court. So if you go to Franklin County Clerk of Courts, look in the civil court division, and just, you know, you can see everything that's being filed, and in most places the filing, if it's an eviction, it'll start with a certain letter. If it's a foreclosure, it'll start with a certain letter. If it's a lawsuit, it'll start with a certain letter. And you just get used to seeing, okay, well, there's a G. That's an eviction. Let me click on that. And then the information about who filed the eviction and what their address is right there in the court records. So short answer, no. You don't have to go downtown. Although going downtown, I have bought a property or two because I have been in eviction court. And I watched some owner who did not know what he was doing get his butt handed to him by the eviction referee. So you're telling me, sir, that you did not, in fact, deliver the original 3D notice through the door? Well, no, I mailed it to him. Well, that's not how it works in Ohio. You can't mail it to them. And then he gets thrown out of court and told to do it all over again. And I have, from time to time, followed that person out of the room and said, hey, are you interested in selling that property instead of having to do this? Because they're so angry, right? They didn't know what they were doing. And it didn't work. Question and answer week on Real Life Real Estate Investing. Give us a call at 877-772-9658 with your questions, or otherwise, send it to vinaradio@gmail.com. I'm seriously going to run out of these email questions here in a moment. Got an email from Dean. Now, that's not what it says at the top of the email. At the top of the email, it says K Hicks Capital Sorrel. But then at the bottom, it says it's from Dean. It says, good morning. We're currently extending funding solutions for viable business and projects seeking capital for expansion, operations, or development as investment loans. Our financing structure is straightforward, competitive, and designed to support serious borrowers across various sectors. If your organization is seeking funding support, kindly reply to this email with a brief overview of your funding needs for further discussion. We look forward to hearing from you. Best regards, Dean. I will not be responding to this because y'all know that these are scams, right? Dean, people who are true business funders or real estate funders, don't find somebody's email and then send a spam email about it. They're actually interested in doing serious business with serious people. That's how we know that you're a scam, Dean. And they also don't post on Facebook. They also just don't go on all the Facebook forums and say, we have funding available for any kind of real estate deal at 5% interest and no points, and hit me up on WhatsApp to get more information. I guess people must fall for this because they keep doing it and they've been doing it for years and years and years. But listeners, y'all know that when DSCR loans are at 7%, there's nobody offering 5% money on any kind of real estate project you might have. Small amounts, big amounts, any amounts. You're going to call them and they're either going to say, well, we need, you know, a $1,500 application fee to get you started, and then you're never going to hear from them again. Or actually, they'll try and get more money from you later, but you'll never get a loan. Or alternatively, you're going to like send them stuff that would be normal to get a loan, like social security numbers and EIN numbers and bank account numbers, and then they're going to steal from you. That is not how real lenders do things. Sorry if I just broke anybody's heart. Let's see. Question here from Nathan. He says, I am a 53-year-old contractor transitioning into real estate investing after decades in remodeling and construction. I understand rehabs and distressed properties well, but I'm struggling with moving from working for income to building actual wealth through investing. My biggest challenge right now is finding real fix and flip cash buyers and building reliable investor relationships instead of constantly chasing the next job. If you were starting all over today with a strong construction experience but limited capital, what would be your first steps to build relationships with serious investors, generate consistent deal flow, and transition from wholesaling into long-term wealth and ownership? The most important question that you asked there was about building relationships with serious investors. Because if you do that, then the other things will sort of come together for you, Nathan. Because you have a very much desired skill set. The thing is, you've been used to trading it for cash money instead of trading it for equity in deals. And there's lots of experienced investors out there, serious investors, who, especially once they understood what you were offering them and understood what the protections would look like and the paperwork would look like and all that sort of stuff, would happily buy a property and pay for the materials and have you fix it all up in return for part of the deal, as opposed to all that taxable cash that you're used to getting. So the real question is, how do you build relationships with those people? And the answer is, you got to find a place where they are. And that's a little bit tougher, because they are not at every RIA. I know, I always tell people, join RIA. And there are RIAs that you go to, and 90% of the people there are brand new investors, and the other 10% are people who seem to be there to take advantage of the brand new investors. I know, I've been to those groups. But there are also a lot of really great groups where there are people who've been in business for 30 years side by side with people who've never done a deal, because the groups are set up in such a way that there's something there for the very experienced people, and there's something there for the people who've never done a deal, and they have figured out how to work together so that the new people aren't just like sucking all the information out of the really experienced people for nothing except for a cup of coffee and my eternal gratitude. And similarly, the people who've been in it for 30 years are not all standing around going, sure, I'll tell you stuff if you give me money. You got to find one of those. Cincinnati RIA is one of those. And I know the name's confusing, because it sounds like you have to live in Cincinnati or invest in Cincinnati or something. And you don't, because most of Cincinnati RIA's meetings are online. And like, if you ever go to the Friday morning meetups, especially the 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock meeting, which is called Prop Swap, you're gonna hear all kinds of very experienced investors making that sort of offer or responding to that sort of offer. Okay, so you're going to find the deal, and you're going to do the labor for free, and I'm going to pay for it, and then you're going to get 25% of the deal. Is that what you're saying? Okay, let's talk about that. I'd be interested in that. To build the relationships, you got to show up. You got to help them where you can, you know, within reason. Like, I'm not saying like, oh, come fix my house for free so that we can have a relationship. I'm saying, if I'm on that call and I say, okay, can anybody give me some advice about how to, I'm trying to think of rehab advice I need, clean a hot tub. No, that's not it. How to deal with a painted metal. There's a piece of metal over one of my windows that kind of keeps the water out, and somebody painted it, and now the paint's flaking, and I don't know how to deal with that. Like, I don't know how to like get it back to where I can paint it again. And just answer the question. You know, I'm not asking you to come do it. Just say, oh, there's this brand of paint that's such and so. And like, people will come to know you because you are helpful, and because, especially if you're bringing deals. If you're showing up and saying, hey, here's a deal, and I'd like somebody to partner with me on it, and here's what I can bring to it, and here's what you can bring to it. So generating consistent deal flow is important, right? And that's going to be largely off-market deals. But transferring from wholesaling into long-term wealth and ownership is going to be about finding the people who've got the money but not the time or the rehab skill and matching them with your time and rehab skill. Because that's a good trade. It doesn't always have to be about you getting money and them getting the property. Sometimes you can both get the property and they can put the money into it. So great question, Nathan. Thank you very much. We need to take a quick break. It is question and answer week. So give us a call at 877-772-9658, or if you want to text in the question, 513-432-4961, or send it to vinaradio@gmail.com. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Question and Answer Week on Real Life Real Estate Investing. I just want to remind everybody, because I know in a world of podcasts, I think I've got the last remaining actual real estate, actual radio show on the planet. Like, I know some of you are listening to it on the app, some of you are listening to it online, some of you are actually listening to it by turning on a radio dial. It's not just radio, it's public radio, which means that we just got to be like super careful about sounding like we're promoting any particular paint brand, big box store, Linder, you know, all of those things that y'all want to ask me about. And I can't. So like Jennifer, you said, can you provide some names for some DSCR lenders that are reputable, no hard money lenders? I can't, because like that's like we just kind of don't name names here on the public radio at all. So here's what I would suggest. You are from West Virginia. I don't know of a real estate association near Charleston, although there was one 10 or 15 years ago. Usually the folks in an association like that know who's lending locally. You could also go to CincinnatiRIA.com and look at the, there's a list of vendors, and a number of those are DSCR people. And if we knew something bad about them, they wouldn't be on the list. So that's how I can guide you, I think. Okay, question from Anonymous. Yeah, she also sent me that via email, that long, long text. I also have it via email, so okay. I don't need to try and read it off your phone there. She says, kindly call me Anonymous. This thing, she says, I'm selling a property on a land installment contract. The person has not made a payment for 7 months and has asked to sell the property. They had put it on the MLS in February and found a buyer, but the realtor allowed 3 months to go by before determining that the buyer's funding was not going through. I realize I let things go too far, because now they haven't paid, even though they haven't paid more than 20% toward the purchase price, they've been paying for just over 5 years. So if we don't get this under control, my only recourse may be to file for foreclosure. Okay, so let me explain that to people who are not from Ohio. Land installment contracts, aka land contracts, aka contracts for deed, are very much governed on a state-by-state basis. In Ohio, the rule is that if the buyer, who we call the vendee, has either made payments for 5 years, so I mean, it's not even made payments, it's if 5 years have gone by since the origination of the land contract, or they have paid 20% or more toward the original purchase price, then we go from having a default process that it takes 60 days plus maybe time to set them out. So it's a little painful, but it's not as painful as a foreclosure is in Ohio. Foreclosures in Ohio are very painful. So what has happened to Anonymous here is that while she was not getting payments for the last 7 months, and while the buyer or the vendee was messing around putting the property on MLS and then accepting a contract from somebody who didn't have any financing, that 5 year mark has, we've ticked past the 5 year mark. That's what all that means. She says, two lawyers have told me that the foreclosure process is long and expensive, but neither can define expensive or long for that matter. It's not going to maybe be as bad as you think it is in terms of expensive. It's probably going to cost you somewhere between $1,500 and $3,500. Long depends on how quick your attorney is to file all the necessary paperwork and whether your buyer ever shows up in court to say, "Your Honor, I need an extension just because I'm a homeowner and I want an extension, so please give me another 30 days. It could take anywhere from 4 months to forever, depending on how quick your attorney is and whether or not there's any objections from the buyer. However, foreclosure is not your only option here. Why would you not go to your buyer and say, "Look, this is not working," rather than have me foreclose on you, which is going to do very bad things to your credit and your ability to buy the next house? Not because I want it to, but because foreclosures just do that. Why don't we just come to an agreement that you release the land contract, you sign a release of land contract, and then you can have a month to move, and I won't go after you for the payments you owe me. You can have like a clean start. Nobody even has to know what's going on. Once they've signed the release of the land contract and you've given them whatever time you want to give them to move, they're really tenants at sufferance at that point, and you can evict them instead of having to go through a whole thing. Maybe even give them cash for keys. I don't know how much equity they have in the house, but maybe you even give them, you offer them cash for keys. She says, "This week the person says they have a buyer, but I can't afford to continue with no payments from the person under the land installment contract. I'd like your insight. Perhaps you can use it as a what not to do if you sell a property using a land installment contract statement." Well, the first thing I would have not done is let them go 7 months without making a payment. I don't care what they're trying to do with the house. They've got to make the payments while they're trying to sell the house. Maybe they got to make the payments, so they got to give it back to me. I mean, the taxes still have to be paid. The insurance still has to be paid. A lot of times there's an underlying loan on this that has to be paid. You have really let them kind of victimize you over the last 7 months. I'm a little surprised that they were able to list the property in MLS. It's not that they are not allowed to sell the property, because as long as they can make you whole, I mean, they do have an equitable interest in the property. I'm just a little surprised you weren't the one who signed the MLS listing agreement, because they don't have title. They won't have title. Well, they won't ever have title in this case. What will happen is you will sell it to their buyer and they will be paid out any equity they have after all of these unpaid payments, the unpaid taxes, the unpaid insurance, and all the late fees that they've been accruing for the last 7 months. I plan to give them until June 15th to sell the property, and if they can't, ask for cancellation. Why don't you do something else? Why don't you say, "I need you to pay me as much of the last 7 months as you can pay me right now," and then also you can keep trying to sell the property, but you got to make the June payment too. You got to make the May payment and the June payment, and also you can have until June the 15th, and then, you know, why don't you turn it over to me? Or better yet, why don't you sign it over to me right now and we'll keep trying to sell it. And whatever equity there is there after all of this stuff that you owe me, I'll give it to you. But this isn't fair that you keep holding me over the barrel month after month after month after month. If they won't cancel, I'll bite the bullet and start the long and expensive road to foreclosure. Yeah, see, I wouldn't wait until June 15 to do that. I would be having this conversation right now. I'd be saying, "What do you want to do? You need to pay me some money, and then you need to make the June payment. And then if you've sold it by June 15th, great. We can just, you know, go forward. But if not, I need you to sign the house over to me." And if they say, "No, I'm not doing any of those things," start the foreclosure process now. If they're not going to give you any money today and they're not going to sign it over to you today, go ahead and start the foreclosure process and say, "Okay, look, I got to do this just because I can't afford this to go on and on and on and on and on and on and on like this. If you get it sold, great. You're going to pay for my lawyer if I have to go that far. And you can have the rest of the money, but otherwise we can't keep doing this. This is crazy." So the first thing that you have to give them is a 30-day notice anyway, and today is May the 13th. So just if you want your lawyer to draft it, if you want to just get it off the internet, whatever, go ahead and give them the 30-day notice today, because that takes you up to June 15th anyway. Have them have this conversation with them that this is just not going to keep going on. You got these choices. Get caught up. Sign it over to me. I want to treat you fair, but you're not treating me fair. There's a bunch of different ways you could work this out depending on what they are going to do. Just don't take another, well, what I will do is I will wait until June 15th, and then if I haven't sold it, then I will sign it over to you. But I'm not going to give you any money in the meantime. No, that's just another 30-day delay. You want me to do another 30-day delay? I need something for that. I either need money or I need a release of the land contract. Otherwise, we're going to go forward, and I hope this works out for you, but at this point, I got to take care of me. Okay, thank you for your question, Anonymous. Very interesting one. We need to take one final break, and it is, in fact, question and answer week. So if you have any further questions, go ahead and send them to vinaradio@gmail.com. And we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones-Cox. It's question and answer week, and I just got a text from Sarah, who's my assistant. You guys are supposed to be texting the station, not texting the office. The station's text number is 513-432-4961. But it's an interesting question. So if there's a married couple on title, but one wants to sell out his part, what are the creative options? The relationship is a little shaky and one person could use the money the other partner doesn't want to sell. Okay, the relationship is more than a little shaky. If we're going, I want to sell my half of our property that we own together because I need the cash. Like there's like, yeah. That okay. So I'm going to assume, even though the text doesn't say so, that we're talking about an investment property. We're not talking about it's our marital home and I'm trying to sell out my half because I need the cash and make you partners with my husband. Like that, not impossible, I guess, but I'm going to assume that we're talking about like either a rental property, an Airbnb, something like that. I'm sure they own the property as tenants in common. That's how most married couples own things. And it is entirely possible for the two of them to agree that his half of the property can be sold to Joe Blow over here. And that, as a result of that sale, what'll happen is there will be a tenants in common relationship where she owns half the deed. And the new partner owns half the property. Okay. I'm sorry. I said they were tenants in common. They're probably joint tenants with right of survivorship. It's probably that, we both own it. And if I die, you get it. Okay. And we're going to have to change the way that's titled because the new title needs to say, Vina's LLC, because Vina bought half the property and wife or wife's LLC. I really prefer that it be wife's LLC. They would have to agree between themselves that it was going to be the husband who got all the money and that this title transfer was going to take place to take the husband completely out and put the wife completely on. If they happen to own it in an LLC and it's the only property they own in an LLC, it could also be done by selling half the shares, the husband's half of the shares in the LLC. So it's doable. I mean, none of that's particularly creative because it feels like hubby wants cash, not to take payments or anything like that. If there is an underlying loan on the property, which I guess there almost always is, the person buying into it would be buying half the equity, right? Because the loan would still stay in place. And of course that puts the husband who's leaving in the position of He's got his name on the bottom of a loan, and now somebody else is half owner and maybe in control of whether that loan gets paid off or not. So there's some things to think about here, but it is 100% doable. You just have to find out what they really want. And, oh, hey, she just sent me the question again on a text. Great. Yeah, so if you could explain, is this a rental property, and is there an underlying loan on it? It is, in fact, very doable, though. Okay, Damon, can you tell me what a master lease is, and would it be a good way to get a fourplex? So a master lease is I rent the entire fourplex from you, not one unit. I rent the whole fourplex from you, and I have the right to sublease it to other people. Because I'm not going to live in all four units. I want a lease that says I pay you $2,000 a month rent, and I have now control over all four units, and then I can rent the four units for whatever I want to rent them for. Is it a good way to get a fourplex? It doesn't get you a property. It just gets you control of the rents of the property. So you would need to add an option to that to ultimately get the property. Is it a good way to get it? Well, it depends. Are you getting a monthly rent that leaves enough room for you to rent out the units and you also make some money, not just the owner makes money? Who's going to be responsible for the expenses? Who's going to be responsible for the roof when it breaks, or the water heater when it breaks, or the windows when they break? Master leases, like any other creative deal, are very different depending on what everybody has negotiated. And also, it depends on if that is what the seller, because he's not, understand he's not really selling it to you until you exercise that option to buy, if there's some benefit to it for the seller. Mostly, master leases with options to buy are benefits to older sellers who have highly depreciated properties and they don't like them anymore, but they also don't want to pay the capital gains taxes on them. I master leased a triplex with an option to buy it from a seller who, he's not actually that old, but he didn't want to manage it anymore, and he was going to have a big old capital gains bill if he sold it, so we agreed that I would just rent it from him for 10 years, that I would pay for all of the expenses, which is a little unusual in most master leases because you don't own the property. You don't pay for the capital expenses, but I agreed to pay for them in return for every dollar that I spent on a capital expenditure got reduced the price that I had to pay in 10 years by a dollar. So yes, it could be, Damon, a good way to get a fourplex. However, you got to find the right seller for that deal. And that's typically going to be an older person, owned the property for a really long time, does not really want it anymore, but also does not want to sell it because they don't want to pay the taxes. Catherine says, hello, Vina. I had set an appointment to see a house. The realtor then called me back saying the seller is selling cash only. This has happened twice in the past few months. I have an approval letter from my bank for a mortgage. If I'm approved, what's the hesitation or problem for the seller? And should I see the house and make an offer, or is this a waste of my time? Well, Catherine, I can think of two really good reasons why a seller would say this is a cash-only deal. Reason number one is the house is not going to qualify for a loan. Maybe the property is, maybe they're asking too much money. Maybe it is, most common reason is the house is not in a condition where lenders are going to be super excited about making a loan on the property. So that has traditionally been the reason that you'll see these in listings. It'll say no FHA or VA, or it'll say cash buyers only. And that's because it's just too rough. Like there's no furnace in the house, or there's mold in the house. And a bank's just going to be like, no, we're not financing this. I think what you may be running across right now is sellers and their agents who are tired of deal after deal after deal falling through because the bank is not appraising the house at the asking price, or they don't feel like it's going to go through because something is going to happen with the bank. Is it a waste of your time to go see it? Well, I mean, they've been pretty clear with you about if you can't pay cash, we're not going to consider your offer. So I guess I would call back and say, is this because you don't think the bank will make the loan, or because you've been messed over one too many times? And if they say, we don't think the bank's going to make the loan, well, you don't qualify to buy that house because you don't have cash. Now, I will say also, Catherine, that hard money and private money pretty much is the same thing as cash, because the house kind of doesn't have to appraise. But if you're gonna do that, you really need to have your private lender with you when you go see the property, because what they're asking for is no financing contingency. So if I were your private lender and I went with you and we walked it together and I said, yeah, I would loan you $120,000 for this property, then you could write them a contract that said no financing contingency, which is the same effectively as cash, and they would probably take that. I don't know, though. We'll see. Sirenaj has a question about how to find experienced investors who can help her build a piece of software. Not like, you know, write the software, but like help her understand what needs to go into it. And my answer to that, Sirenaj, is come to the Friday morning haves and wants calls and tell people what you're building and say, I need help from people understanding what you need, and people will help you. That seems to be the end of our questions, which is a good thing, I guess, because it is the end of our time. Do we have time for this? Where can we go to listen to old programs? Okay, I'm going to answer that one real quick. You want to go to reallifereallestate.com, or you can get them on Spotify, either place, reallifereallestate.com or Spotify. And boy, you can just go back and listen to hundreds and hundreds of programs. You can just hear my voice 24/7 for a really long time. Awesome. That is the end of our show today. Appreciate all you folks who sent in these great and very interesting and wide-ranging questions today. Good job, and hope it helped. We'll be back next week with more information to put you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. Until then, happy investing.